wonder who determines how many bears may be killed in Vermont during the hunting season, or the length of the otter trapping season, or other matters that are of importance to Vermonters? Do you expect that these decisions not be politicized and instead be made by impartial biologists who are working to ensure what's best for wildlife, not for hunters and trappers? You aren't alone, but that's not the reality. We'll delve into this more today. Join me, Brenna Galdenzi, president of Protect Our Wildlife, Lisa Jablow, Protect Our Wildlife board member, and Walter Medwid, co-founder of Vermont Wildlife Coalition, who holds an MS and BS in biology. Walter is a recipient of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Silver Eagle Award. He participated in the historic conservation project of translocating Canadian wolves to return them to Yellowstone, and has studied wolves in Yellowstone, Minnesota, and the Northwest Territories. We'll be discussing the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Board and the changes that need to be made to offer Vermonters true democracy and wildlife governance. So welcome, Walter. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, nice to be here.
So you two are probably the ones who I've been most in contact with and have been most involved examining, you know, the fish and wildlife governance process and how all the different voices are heard or not heard, and who are these fish and wildlife board members who are making life or death decisions on wildlife here in Vermont. And so I think probably out of the gate, talk about what does the Fish and Wildlife Board do? A lot of people are very confused as to what their role is and, you know, why this all-volunteer board that doesn't necessarily have any training in science or biology, you know, why they have such power and control over regulations here in Vermont. So Walter, do you want to kind of launch the topic, the discussion, kind of starting off with the Fish and Wildlife Board, how they're appointed, who appoints them, and anything else you want to cover to get us started?
Sure. I'll take a stab at that. The board is somewhat of an anomaly in Vermont's governance. Most departments functioning in the state of Vermont have a professional staff, and the professional staff have significant authority within law to make determinations and operate their various agencies and departments. What's different, though, within fish and wildlife resources is the fact that the authority is divided. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has direct authority only over non-game species. Think turtles, think bats. Whereas the Fish and Wildlife Board has authority over game species, those species that are fished, hunted, and trapped. And there's some background that I think is important with regard to understanding sort of the history here. In the 1970s, there was a movement to modernize Vermont's governance by transitioning from boards and commissions, which made the bulk of the decisions about how our government would function, to professionalizing the various agencies and departments within the government. And that meant hiring professionals with credentials to begin to make those decisions and wean ourselves away from boards and commissions that perhaps lacked some of the credentials that professionals would have. However, that never fully happened with regard to the Department of Fish and Wildlife. They were granted authority only over non-game species, and the Fish and Wildlife Board retained authority over game. And I think there's a few reasons why that may be the case. Number one, the whole idea of transitioning from boards and commission to professional staff was somewhat controversial. The boards and commissions often didn't want to give up their power. Number two, there was a sense within the hunting and trapping community that by hiring professionals, sort of the benefits that they enjoyed when their peers served on a board might be jeopardized by these professionals. And so there was some resistance there. And perhaps the third reason is the fact that in the 70s, that was the heyday of hunting, fishing, and trapping license sales. And so it was an important and powerful political force. And so rather than fight that current, the board kept its power and the division was made between the department overseeing game, non-game, and the board retaining its power over game species. And specifically, the board has the authority to make regulations, determine seasons, determine take amounts, determine which species may be hunted and trapped in fish and which species may not. And so that part of their role is indeed to create regulations. But ultimately, the board also has the authority to make public policy. Their recommendations collectively establish Vermont's public policy on how game species, deer, turkey, fox, river otter, bear, are all managed. And I'll just conclude by saying there's significant regulatory and public policy authority within the board, and yet the board has only been represented by hunters and trappers, and all other segments of the public have not been allowed to be represented on that body.
And just to piggyback on that, you know, the board has 14 members, one from each county. They're appointed by the governor, and they serve a six-year term. And later on in the discussion, Lisa will delve more into that. But Walter, your introduction there just really hits home the fact that this board really seems to be a remnant of the past. Out of all of the boards and commissions here in Vermont, I think that the one that really needs to evolve to meet a changing culture here in Vermont with respect to how we view wildlife is the Fish and Wildlife Board. I think we really need to question and challenge if they are really representing the interests of all Vermonters. And I just kind of want to, I think it's important to share how Protect Our Wildlife became knowledgeable about this Fish and Wildlife Board. Because really prior to late 2015, I really didn't know much about this Fish and Wildlife Board and how they operated. And it was only until a trapper, who's now a lobbyist in Montpelier, submitted a proposal to the Fish and Wildlife Department to extend the trapping seasons on bobcats and otters, and also to extend the trap check times for water traps, did I really get to see the sausage-making process. And it was pretty ugly. And, you know, knowing from a sound science wildlife management perspective, and Walter, you having the background in this more so than anyone on this call, I mean, there really is no biological imperative to be killing otters and bobcats in the first place. You know, they both act as key predators in their ecosystems and should be protected, you know, not trapped and killed for their pelts or for recreation or for quote unquote predator management. But we find too often that Fish and Wildlife, they don't base their decisions in sound science. A lot of the decisions are based in catering to their customers, and their customers being license holders, trappers, and hunters. And I think it's also important to mention that science doesn't necessarily tell us that we need to be trapping bobcats and otters in the first place. I mean, all their science can tell us is how many of these animals can we trap and kill and not decimate the population. So when we think about science and how science is used, we really need to be careful and make sure that we understand what this science really involves. And I don't know if you two were in attendance at the first Fish and Wildlife Board hearing. I think it was out in Woodbury, where Fish and Wildlife was hearing this trapper's proposal to extend bobcat and otter trapping season. But we had our folks flood the building. I mean, I think people had to stand outside. There were so many of our members there. And I want to say there were over 3,000 people who signed a petition opposing the trapper's proposal. But despite all of this, the Fish and Wildlife Department approved the trapper's petition. They extended the trapping season on river otters through the end of March. So previously, the trapping season on otters was end of October through the end of February, and the trapper wanted to trap otters through the end of March. And what's interesting is that Vermont Fish and Wildlife's website had said that the trapping season for river otters runs through the end of February in order to protect nursing otter mothers and their pups. And then when they supported the trappers' petition to extend the otter trapping season through the end of March, and we asked them, well, what about the otter pups and the nursing mothers? And they said, oh, the website information is out of date. That's old information. That's no longer a concern. So that these types of things really is what caused us to start having distrust in this decision-making process. And that's the otter piece of it. The Fish and Wildlife Department did reject the proposal to extend the bobcat trapping season. And one of the reasons why they chose to not support that is because they lacked data. They couldn't confidently say that they could extend the trapping season on bobcats without really negatively impacting their populations. And that's because trappers weren't returning their trapper reports. So the Fish and Wildlife Department provided their input to the board to not extend the bobcat trapping season. And despite this, half of the Fish and Wildlife Board, remember, this Fish and Wildlife Board is composed of bobcat trappers, voted to override Fish and Wildlife's recommendation. So that there is the one of the dangerous things about the board. They can do whatever they want without having to answer to anyone. Luckily, the request to extend the bobcat trapping season did not pass. But the fact that half of the board decided to go against the Fish and Wildlife Department biologist's recommendation is very, very frightening. And again, let's just remember this whole process to extend both the otter trapping season and the bobcat trapping season, it was done to appease less than 1% of the population that traps. And this whole rulemaking process is what it's called. So whenever someone petitions or submits a proposal to the Fish and Wildlife Board, it goes through a process. This whole process of enacting this regulation took 2 years and potentially tens of thousands of dollars it cost the Fish and Wildlife Department to advance this trapper's petition to extend trapping seasons on two species who shouldn't be trapped in the first place. So that's a real short version of that indoctrination into the Fish and Wildlife Board rulemaking process. It was an eye-opening experience for wildlife advocates across the state. It resulted in tremendous support for our work as a watchdog over fish and wildlife. And it's really caused us to be on guard for future rulemaking proposals. So let's loop back again, if we can, Walter, just to explain to the folks, you know, how do people get on the Fish and Wildlife Board? What's the process? I mean, a Fish and Wildlife Board appointment just opened up for my county, Lamoille County. The current Fish and Wildlife, the current Fish and Wildlife Board member from Lamoille County used to be the president of the Vermont Trappers Association. So imagine how little he represented me in my county. You know, I chose not to apply because I knew that they would just, you know, toss my application in the garbage. So how does the average, you know, person apply? How do people get on the board, Walter?
The primary path is by the department staff, senior staff in particular, are looking out and aware that there will be vacancies on in those 14 positions. And so they are on the job of identifying potential individuals who do embrace the hunting and trapping tradition and are supportive of upholding that as the highest priority of the department. And so those individuals are identified, recruited, cultivated. Certainly the governor is the one that makes those appointments, but again, it starts with, again, the cultivation, the identification and cultivation by department staff. Certainly people can self-nominate, but the process is a very obscure process. There is nothing in the local newspaper or in other media that says, oh, by the way, there will be a opening on the Lamoille County seat to serve on the Fish and Wildlife Board, opening in April, let's say. It's not an open, it's not inclusive. And the reason for that is that it's designed to be entirely selective to serve special interests. That is, unless you've been identified to be completely embrace the concept, is that the highest use of wildlife is hunting and trapping uses, you will not be recommended to serve on the board. And if you self-nominate and not embrace that position, you will not be selected. So again, it's a very closed, behind closed door process. Very well-qualified people with wildlife credentials have applied and have really been thrown under the bus. So it reinforces a mantra that I've repeated often, is that the board has powerful regulatory and public policy-making authority over public assets that must serve the public, and yet there is not one seat representing the larger public seated at the table, at the decision-making table. And even if there were just one, it would be of little value if 13 others were upholding different views. So again, we've got a system that simply defies the public interests.
And let's remember, you know, all of the members on this 14-member Fish and Wildlife Board either hold hunting, trapping, or fishing licenses. And currently, there are 12 white men and 2 women. So that is our board. Lisa, recently, you know, you have been serving as the liaison between Protect Our Wildlife and the governor's office, trying to get information on who some of these applicants are. And as I just mentioned, there was a board vacancy for my county, Lamoille County, and also Windham County.
My county.
Your county. You should have applied.
Right.
So can you explain to us some of the sausage making in this appointment process?
Well, as Walter said so eloquently, there is a lot of obfuscation in this process, and we don't know exactly when it starts, and we don't know exactly when it closes. All we know is that there are upcoming vacancies in certain counties. And what I have done the last couple of years is, when we are aware that there are vacancies, I send a double request for records pertaining to the process to both the governor's office and to the Fish and Wildlife Board. And what happens following those requests is, I'm pretty sure, although I can't confirm it, is that there is some back and forth between the two offices, because the response that I get from each is always, okay, we've got your request, we'll get back to you. So the governor's office usually gets back first. They say, we're working on it. And then following that, I get a response from Fish and Wildlife saying pretty much the same thing. And for this most recent round, I have already heard back from the governor's office with records. I have received nothing but a, we got your request from Fish and Wildlife, and I have followed up with them, but so far have not heard anything. So what I got from the governor's office this time was the usual boilerplate set of applications, people who have been, you know, longtime members of the Vermont Trappers Association, or, you know, have hunted all their lives or fished all their lives. But an interesting thing came up in that there was also some material that documented some phone calls initiated by Lewis Porter. It started out as an email, but he was requesting a phone call with someone in the governor's office to talk about a board question. And when I looked a little more closely at that correspondence, it seemed that he had someone in mind that he wanted to discuss with the governor's office. I don't know whether he wanted to make them aware of this person or whether he wanted to find out how this person's application would fare in the governor's office. So we decided to drill down a little deeper and make a second request to the governor's office, specifically to the person that Porter had contacted, to find out more about the substance of their phone conversations. What they had agreed to do was to set up a meeting to discuss this by phone. And what I received back from the governor's office was, you've already made your records request. If you want more information, you have to make another records request. And this was sort of a little bit of a different animal, because we had already received records per se. What we were looking for was some more information about the substance of their phone conversations and, you know, hopefully why they were even having them in the first place. So that's where things stand. Things are up in the air. We haven't heard anything back from Fish and Wildlife yet with regard to any records that they may be willing to disperse to us. We have whatever the governor's office is going to send us. And by the way, I should also mention that when we do make these requests, well, very often there are some redactions. So
redactions, we do see that quite frequently with public records requests. And sometimes they're justified. Sometimes we question those redactions. I think really what, Lisa, as you illuminated, the issue here is that we have the Fish and Wildlife Department commissioner, you know, who really is supposed to be working for all of us, who is, what it appears, making recommendations, not in a public way where it's captured at all in any public records, recommendations for the Fish and Wildlife Board appointment. And we don't know what these recommendations are. We don't even know if the person that he's recommending is even going to fill out an application or send a resume or submit a CV. That person might just end up the Fish and Wildlife Board member one day, and there's no paper trail. And that is the problem. Lisa, you also wrote a really fantastic commentary on this very topic that was published in VT Digger. I think it was in 2019 or 2020. And what prompted your commentary was, you know, this Fish and Wildlife Board appointment process, and how lack of transparency. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about what that public records request revealed and what your letter covered?
Sure. Well, actually, it was in part prompted by the very situation to which you alluded, that being that somebody can just show up on the board without having submitted any kind of paperwork. And that's exactly what happened. So in August of 2018, there was a meeting with the governor that included Protect Our Wildlife and a number of other organizations and other stakeholders, people advocating for animals. And they wanted to discuss with the governor the whole way of making these public policy decisions and regulations, particularly with regard to Fish and Wildlife Board appointments. And what had happened was that a few months before, there were several board vacancies. And what resulted from the application process, even though there were, it turned out, several highly qualified people who had applied for positions, when we made the records request pursuant to that particular round of board vacancies, those applications never even showed up. And it was discovered by, I think, someone in the Fish and Wildlife Office that, oh, yes, we seem to have this application that we, oops, didn't send you. And as that process unfolded, it turned out that there were actually four applications of highly qualified people with advanced degrees and expertise that was very, very pertinent to serving on that board. And what wound up happening was that not only were those applications completely ignored, but the person who was appointed to one of those board vacancies never even submitted anything. All of a sudden, there he was. And we subsequently tried to obtain any information at all about him or about the process by which he was installed on the board, and we got crickets. And I further went on to elaborate on a situation that occurred because there were a number of students from Vermont Law School who were seeking to put some boundaries on the coyote hunting season. They were not trying to eliminate the season, and that's a very important point. They were simply trying to regulate it a little bit. And they submitted a petition to the board that had over 12,000 signatures on it. And this person, this new appointed member, was the person who stood up and made the motion to shoot the petition down. And that was the end of that. So one of the last points that I made in this letter was that as part of this process, not only are we shut out of most of the inner workings, but there is kind of a standard line that is included in correspondence with potential applicants to the effect that, you know, if you are considering serving on this board, you need to be aware that there is a dynamic that you will have to deal with the anti-trapping lobby, that is us. So, you know, there is a sort of a bunker mentality that is part of the whole process. So that was the gist of the letter, that I was trying to shed some light on the secrecy of the process and the fact that the governor's office and the Fish and Wildlife Board are not forthcoming with regards to how that board is made up.
So we have these, you know, legitimate concerns about, you know, little to no knowledge on who these Fish and Wildlife Board members are and what their qualifications are. And it's been our experience that, you know, some of them lack just basic professionalism. And just recently, over the past year, one of the new newly appointed Fish and Wildlife Board members has posted just some really distasteful Facebook posts on his public Facebook page. And, you know, we are not ones to stifle free speech, and it's his Facebook page. But if you're going to have a public Facebook page where anyone can see what you're posting, I have to kind of consider what kind of image are you projecting to those Vermonters who you are supposed to be serving as a Fish and Wildlife Board member, making decisions, you know, on wildlife here in Vermont. Some of those Facebook posts made by this particular Fish and Wildlife Board member have been shared with legislators by one of our members, and we're not sure what they're going to do with it. But again, it just further illuminates the issue of lack of professionalism. And something else, Walter, I know you and I have talked about this before. You know, there are some very real conflict of interest concerns. You know, we had a taxidermist who was on the board, and I know, you know, she could have made somewhere in the realm of $250 off of a red fox mount. And there was a petition before the board when she was on it that requested or a proposal to halt the trapping and hunting season on foxes. And, you know, that board member didn't recuse herself, You know, we also had two nuisance wildlife control operators who were trappers who have weighed in on topics and discussions that might impact their practice and their business. They didn't recuse themselves. You know, as far as I know, this board doesn't have their members fill out any kind of conflict of interest forms. I mean, Protect Our Wildlife, we're an all-volunteer grassroots nonprofit. You know, our board members had to fill out conflict of interest forms, you know, but this board, who has a very, very powerful role, you know, they don't have to do that. And I forgot to mention the prior chairman of the Fish and Wildlife Board, who's an avid trapper. When we first started, it was a very, very contentious relationship exchanges between him and Protect Our Wildlife, where he would routinely try to discredit us and demean us. And he would always refer to us as, quote unquote, the gang of six, when he would either post comments online or, you know, trying to make us appear as though we were, you know, a small group or a group that should be ignored. I think he'd be really humbled now to see that this, quote unquote, gang of six is now, you know, a membership here in Vermont that is much larger than that and has been successful in many ways representing wildlife. So again, you know, we have lack of professionalism, we have conflict of interest concerns, we have basic issues where the board wasn't even complying with open meeting law requirements. You know, when we first kind of got on the scene back in 2015, 2016, the Fish and Wildlife Board, when it was chaired by this trapper, they weren't even allowing public comment. So we would attend these Fish and Wildlife Board meetings and we would request to, you know, make a public comment or to weigh in. And we were told, you know, that you're not allowed. And then we escalated it to the general counsel at Fish and Wildlife Department, who then asked the board to make sure that they allow a public comment process. And then it was a 1 minute public comment, which they then increased to 2 minutes. So it's just, you know, things like that, that if Protect Our Wildlife were not on the scene, not challenging some of the practices, you know, I fear that a lot of these really unethical and undemocratic practices would probably still be happening. And, you know, talking about our experience working with the Fish and Wildlife Board, Lisa, you already touched upon the Vermont Law School students' proposal to have a regulated coyote hunt versus the current open season and how, you know, that was received. They shot it down. But I think, Lisa, and maybe Walter, you were in attendance last January when I presented to the Fish and Wildlife Board on Protect Our Wildlife's petition. And our petition simply asked that trappers be required to set their traps away from public areas, away from trailheads, away from recreational areas. And we were treated just so disrespectfully. And Lisa, you were there. Walter, I'm not sure if you were there. You know, I was the one that was presenting. I was on the hot seat. I felt like I was being interrogated. What was your impression of the exchange, Lisa?
Well, it was less than warm and fuzzy, let's put it that way. My recollection is not only was there a lot of, you know, a very pronounced undercurrent of hostility, but I think if I recall correctly, they also had you leave your seat to come up to basically front and center of the room to be questioned and challenged by the board members. I think I remember you asking to just be able to make your comments from where you were because everybody else that had commented was allowed to do that. And they made you come up to the middle of the room so that, you know, you could be spotlighted and things went from there. They're dug in. I mean, they don't really have anything to support what they're doing. And then all of a sudden in 2015, POW shows up and they're getting called out on their process, their lack of science, their lack of transparency, their lack of inclusivity, you know, people are coming to and calling into meetings. You know, it's a brave new world for them. And as it is around the rest of the country, they're just digging in. You know, we're coming for their traps. And pretty soon, if they allow that to happen, it'll be their guns.
Well, it was really discouraging because, again, our petition was so fair. You know, again, we were only asking that, you know, trappers set their traps away from recreational areas. And one of the board members, in a hostile manner, you know, said, well, you just want to ban all trapping. And then there was another board member who almost, you know, tried to bargain with me and say something to the effect that if I approve this petition, will you promise not to ask for anything else? And then that same board member also asked me, you know, why he couldn't sign up for POW's mailing list. And it was just a very, very hostile environment, you know, for a volunteer member of the public to be presenting in what seemed like a firing squad. I was right in the middle of all of their chairs. And there was another board member who I actually walked up to during the break to share with him, you know, how discouraged I was with how, you know, he treated me. I was hoping to have a conversation with him about that. And, you know, he just brushed it off. And even more so, what's really deeply concerning is that another one of our members who was in attendance that night, she contacted me after the meeting, shortly after the meeting. And she said, well, Brenna, forget about me ever presenting to the Fish and Wildlife Board. You know, after how they treated you, don't ever think I'm going to get up there and make a public comment. And that is the crux of my issue here, is that the public should not feel intimidated or they should not feel afraid to get in front of the Fish and Wildlife Board and share a petition or share a public comment. And if the members of the public saw how I was treated, and if that's going to discourage them from getting involved in the process, you know, that is not good. That is not good for wildlife governance. That is not good for the democracy of wildlife management. It is shutting out voices of various stakeholders. And I wrote to the chair of the Fish and Wildlife Board after I received that feedback from one of our members and shared the concerns with him. And didn't really hear much back on that, but I thought it was important that I share that with him. So in closing, you know, I think effectively highlighted a lot of the problems that we have with the Fish and Wildlife Board and our concerns, and it doesn't seem like things are getting any better. You know, what happens if we don't change the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Board? I mean, because of the past 6 years or so and what we've witnessed and how they operate, there is justifiably, you know, a lot of distrust in the process and how decisions are made to serve, you know, narrow special interests. You know, Walter, I guess I'd like to kind of hand this over to you. What do you think will happen if we don't change how things are done?
Change is upon us. Whether we like it or not, change is upon us. Change is occurring within the wildlife profession over the last several decades. Wildlife professionals have written multiple peer-reviewed papers that talk about the need to transform, to recognize that we are in a new world. I alluded to the fact that in the 70s, that was the heyday of license sales. License sales have plummeted. Hunting is down by more than 50%. Trapping down by 50%. Fishing down. Combo licenses down. Youth licenses down by close to 50%. The culture is changing. The wildlife profession has recognized that. And again, the multiple papers of peer-reviewed papers have really telegraphed that. And I would say much of the papers have been summarized in a paper done by Dr. Decker and colleagues called Wildlife Governance Principles for the 21st Century. It really reflects, I think, the thinking of the last several decades and recognizes the change in the culture and comes up with a new standard by which wildlife decisions need to be made. And I would say that paper and that perspective has been endorsed by the organization that represents the interest of state fish and wildlife agencies. That group is called the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. The Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department is a member, a dues-paying member of that association. They issued a blue panel report blue ribbon panel report that really had two recommendations. One had to do with funding, but the other had to do with recognizing that the world has changed, our culture has changed, ecological conditions have changed. We must transform our wildlife governance. We must transform our departments of fish and wildlife to recognize that the world has changed and our governance practices and principles must change. But I would also say that that is happening on the professional level. It's happening within the industry voice for fish and wildlife agencies. Even a survey done by Colorado State University of Department of Fish and Wildlife employees in Vermont, the majority responded that the department is not doing enough to respond to change. And perhaps the last leg in the stool that I would point to are the surveys that have been done through the University of Minnesota Center for Rural Studies of Vermonters are indicating that the public is on board with major change to the way that we manage wildlife. There's a disconnect there. So I think there's a tsunami of forces that are growing. It's simply a matter of time. It's simply a matter of when do we arrive at a tipping point. The legislature has never seen as many pressures, letters, comments regarding the need for change. So I don't think it's a matter of if, it's a matter of when we will make substantive changes to the Fish and Wildlife Board, and also that the department becomes a department that reflects public interests and not special interests as their primary customer.
Yeah, you really just pulled all of the salient points together, and you're absolutely right. And I don't think any one of us wants to distrust fish and wildlife. It's not fun, you know, just waiting for the next petition to show up that might want to increase the take on bears or increase the trapping season on bobcats again. Sometimes we feel like we're just sitting ducks, and it shouldn't be that way. And there has to be a way for us to work together in the future. And, you know, our movement, the wildlife advocacy movement, is growing. I mean, in just 6 years since Protect Our Wildlife has been on the scene, I mean, we have experienced such tremendous growth and people who are just so thankful that finally there are organizations in Vermont, there's just a few of us, but that are really challenging the status quo and are really demanding that, you know, all of our voices be heard and that better protections are in place for wildlife. And we're not going away. And the more that we're marginalized and the more that we're ignored is just going to get more people to join the cause. So this has just been a really good discussion. And I am so grateful for both of you. And I just want to remind our listeners that you can request copies of our ethics complaint. We submitted two separate ethics complaints to the Ethics Commission back in 2019 with respect to the Fish and Wildlife Board. And we have documents to share if anyone's interested. And you can find us at protectourwildlifevt.org. You can also email us at info@protectourwildlifevt.org. And you can call us at 253-1592. Lisa, Walter, do you have anything in closing that you'd like to share? Well, no surprise, we've gone over the time, but that's okay.
Well, I would just, one comment about the board is that I think one way to summarize the board is, again, it's unaccountable to the legislature, to the governor, or to the public. It is uncredentialed. They do not have, at a time of increasingly complex decision-making regarding wildlife, they lack the credentials to really represent good public policy while they're making public policy. And certainly they're unelected. Essentially, they're a fourth branch of government that are out of the reach, and they're free in that six-year term to make major decisions, but again, completely unaccountable. It's time for that to change.
And Lisa, I know that you will keep us up to date on your communications with the governor's office. We're trying to get record of who the Commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, Lewis Porter, who is he recommending to serve on the Fish and Wildlife Board? Why is that not in any of the public records that we requested? So I know that you will let me know as soon as you hear back from the governor's office, and we will notify our members accordingly. So thank you, protectors of wildlife, and onwards and upwards for wildlife.